Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now on episode number 593. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm back with another excellent episode. Really excited to get together today and speak about an important and always timely subject. We'll get to that in a second. I want to introduce to you our panel. We have first Jeff Waddington, one of the co-founders here of Reformed Forum. He's calling in from Norristown, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's good to speak with you.
Good to be here from Norristown.
Did I say it right?
You did. Very good.
I would say Norristown, but the people from Norristown say it that way. Anyway,
Norristown.
Thank you, Jeff. It's good to see you, brother. We're also very pleased to welcome to the program, I believe for the first time on the program, though we've met before, Dr. Richard M. Gamble, who's professor of history, Anna Margaret Ross Alexander Chair in History and Politics at Hillsdale College out in Hillsdale, Michigan. Welcome to the program, Richard. It's great to speak with you.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Camden, and it's good to connect with you too, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, we should clarify, as most people ought to know, we hope, but we were joking beforehand and how there's often confusion between Richard M. Gamble and Richard C. Gamble, I believe, at RPTS, if that's his middle initial, I believe. And we recently spoke with Whitney Gamble, who's a tremendous historian, and she's the daughter of the other Richard Gamble. So we're speaking with the Richard Gamble at Hillsdale College. He's written a tremendous book. He's written several books and done several interviews and lectures in the past. But today we're going to be speaking about A Fiery Gospel, The Battle Hymn of the Republic, and The Road to Righteous War, which is in the Religion and American Public Life series. It's published by Cornell University Press this year. It's very new. Amazon, at least right now, says it will be released Wednesday, May 15th. So I believe it's out in Kindle because I have a copy. Thank you very much for that, Richard. And I'm looking forward to talking about this. I've been able to look through the book. We're going to talk about it today. But just before we get started in that and start opening up to a bit of American history and national and civil religion, we're going to speak about just a couple things going on. We don't have a whole lot to announce, although it has been a busy time here at Reformed Forum. And we're delighted to report that the conference for the fall is coming along. We're working on getting precise conference topics, but our subject matter, as the board has determined, is going to be based on Romans 7:14, where the law is spiritual. So that's a rather, can be a contentious subject, but we want to dive down into the relationship of the law as it was revealed specifically to Moses in that whole redemptive historical era, and how that pertains to the ministry of the Holy Spirit, and especially with understanding the age of the Spirit as described in Romans and especially in Galatians. So we're going to get to that. But the dates for that are October 11th and 12th, 2019. And so if you'd like to book your weekend and make sure you've got that free to come all the way up to Grays Lake, Illinois, we look forward to having you. That's, again, October 11th and 12th. We'll have the VIP dinner Friday night, the 11th, and then all day Saturday the 12th, there'll be the conference. And we're looking forward to having everybody here back at Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Also, we're hard at work on the Wimberley Conference, getting that to video. I just saw a rough cut of it last night, of the first installment, the first rough cut, and it's looking great. So I want to keep everybody up to date on that and let you know that we hope by the fall we'll have something on video that you can use in your churches and in independently on your own, and also in studies at church. So we're looking forward to all that. Well, that's all I've got. Jeff, you have anything to announce or anything to update people regarding?
Not at this point.
Yeah.
Traveling here and there, doing pulpit supply, and I'm going to be in Memphis, outside of Memphis, in Collierville at Wolf River.
Oh, great.
Presbyterian Church on the 2nd of June. So that'll be my first time in Tennessee.
Oh, I love Tennessee. Beautiful. I was just had my first time in South Carolina, and I forgot to announce that, but I'll try to put a link that I was very privileged to deliver the first Jerry Crick Memorial Lecture in Apologetics at Greenville Seminary. They hosted the event at Taylor's OPC, which is just down the street from the seminary, and had a wonderful time with the brothers there. Loved staying with and spending time with Tony and Kathleen Curto, but the entire faculty there is very warm and welcoming, and had a lot of good conversations on theology and about, on apologetics. So a lot of good folks down there, and encourage people to check it out, Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary, and the lectures on YouTube. So we'll have a link there as well. Well, let's get into the subject matter today. Looking forward to talking about this, a fiery gospel. Now, Richard, I'd like to just open by giving you the opportunity to speak perhaps more about your research interests in general and the kinds of things you like doing at Hillsdale and the other types of projects that you've been working on in the past, because I think that'll perhaps provide an entree into this specific subject and help us understand the larger academic, intellectual, theological, historical context for it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I don't think I knew 30 years ago that I was going to end up specializing in American civil religion. Mm. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the First World War and the social gospel clergy in America, and trying to understand how these peace advocates, so-called, end up becoming such such fiery, I'll use that word, such fiery advocates for intervention in the war, with such extravagant claims for what the war would achieve for the redemption of human civilization. And that book was finally published in 2003, as you mentioned, The War for Righteousness. And then I followed up.
That was with ISI. Sorry to interrupt, but is that, that's the same outfit that Daryl used to work with, Daryl Hart?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And ISI also brought out an anthology that I did, edited, about the history of education in the West.
Wonderful.
Some primary readings there. That's a bit of a sideline for me. Then in 2012, I brought out the book In Search of the City on a Hill, which reexamined the origin of the phrase city on a hill, went back and looked at John Winthrop and the Puritans, and looked at his appropriation of the Sermon on the Mount and how that actually made its way into American political rhetoric. It took a surprisingly long time for Americans to start calling themselves a city on a hill. And that reflects my interest. I don't know the German phrase. Probably you do, but there's the type
not
of
anymore.
History called reception history.
Oh, sure, sure.
Right. And I didn't know I was thinking and writing in a genre, but apparently I am. And it's I'm fascinated by how ideas and a work like the Battle Hymn of the Republic, how it gets received and transmitted, and how subsequent history and experience ends up changing, not necessarily changing the meaning of it, but the use of it changes over time, the appropriation of it changes over time. And one of the things I say at the end of this book is our tendency as historians, especially of American religion, especially evangelical historians of American religion, they ask the question, what did the Bible do to America? And my question is, what did America do to the Bible? Mm-hmm. That's part of that reception history, that transmission history. And what happens to our faith? What happens to the church? What happens to the Bible when it gets appropriated for purposes alien to it? And I think that runs right through my work.
Well, I definitely picked up on that in this book and thought it was tremendous. My favorite sentence of yours in this book, and I'm going to read it all through it very closely, and I'm sure I'll find more, but right at the end of the epilogue, you write, "A good memory subverts the purposes of nation building." And I find that really useful to see not only how these main ideas are appropriated from various sources, from the Bible, from other aspects of history, other national myths, and become this sort of, I don't know, fodder, they come into this national milieu. And then all of that, through some interesting kind of corporate intellectual activity, starts to direct and orient where the nation goes. And then we all come to this, it may be more challenged now with current events, but, you know, maybe at least 3 years ago, we would have thought there'd be more agreement on some basic ideas. But even today, there's still this core, these core aspects of civil religion about what the United States in particular is or what we should be. Right. And that's tremendous. That's a real exciting aspect of historical theology. And people need to know that. And I think even young students realize that history for many can be very boring because they approach it in terms of just names and dates and factoids and whatnot, but to think about how ideas change and morph and shift, and not just the ideas change through history, but then the ideas change the history as moving yes. forward and change people. It's really tremendous. And that really came through in the book here, A Fiery Gospel.
That's great to hear. That's very encouraging. I sometimes joke that I want to make the battle hymn unsingable.
yeah. Well, I've heard some renditions that were unsingable.
Unsingable, yeah.
Unlistenable. That's true. Well, if I could just tell a personal anecdote here about I want to say the practical side of what I've been researching over the years, but I actually came into the OPC because of my research. When I was in graduate school, late 80s, early 90s, I was researching, as I mentioned, about the First World War, the social gospel clergy, and I ran into this guy, J. Gresham Machen.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of him. And I thought, wow, he really knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. He knows what's at stake here. And then I did a postdoc at George Mason University, and I opened the Yellow Pages, and I saw the OPC work in Vienna, Virginia. I said, well, you know, as a tribute to Machen, I'm sure this denomination has gone liberal like every other denomination. But as a tribute to Machen, I'm going to go visit one of his congregations. And I was blown away. And that got me into the OPC. And for good or ill, I've been here ever since.
Yeah. Well, you know, for many of us, we have similar stories. And, you know, I find a little bit of overlap, or at least an echo in my own personal ecclesiastical journey with what Machen experienced. And so many of us find home here. There's some aspects here to what we're going to be speaking about with the United States and with the OPC. I mean, there's still a mythology to the OPC, and I don't mean that in the sense of, you know, Greek mythology and whatnot, but there's a shared story and a shared history that is definitely operative within the denomination, and we look to that. That can have very good effects. It can also, you know, blind us to other things. So it's always helpful to talk about these matters and to understand them, but I think on most fronts, we definitely appreciate the churchmanship and the work of Machen in a lot of things, even though he's being called into question today for various things of his own time, which we can get into in other episodes. Richard, I was hoping if you could speak with us just to provide an introduction to the Battle Hymn of the Republic, speaking about some of the basic historical details in terms of when it was written, drafted, where it was published, who wrote it, and that sort of thing. I know the whole episode we're going to talk about its history and its effect, so we can't cover all that in just one question. But in terms of the introductory right. aspects, what are some of the basic features?
Yeah, and I'm even going to take a step back here and talk Please. A little bit about the poet, Julia Ward Howe.
Oh, even better. Yeah.
There are books out there about the Battle Hymn of the Republic. There are biographies out there, including one fairly recent one about Julia Ward Howe, but they're not pursuing the questions I'm pursuing. And I ended up with so much material about Julia Ward Howe, digging through the archives in New York, in Boston, that I realized I was writing two books at once. I was writing a biography, an intellectual religious biography, mm-hmm. and I was writing a book about the Battle Hymn. So I hope to get back to that other material. It's really rich, fascinating, complex material. I'm trying to introduce people to a battle hymn they don't know and to a poet they don't know. Julia Ward Howe, she was not born in Boston. She was born in Lower Manhattan. Her father was a very successful banker. She came from a very privileged home. He himself, and this is something that does not come out in her standard biographies, her parents were very devout evangelical Episcopalians. I have read family letters. Her father was extremely devout man, leading family worship, attended a church, was member of a church in Manhattan that was a leading church in the evangelical movement within Episcopalianism in the 1820s, 1830s. Her mother was very devout. Her mother's brother was a very prominent Episcopal minister in Brooklyn for decades. And Julia Ward Howe turned away from all of that. She was baptized into the church. She was confirmed. She took First Communion in the Episcopal Church, and she turned her back on all of it. And I don't know the whole story yet about that, but certainly by the time she married Samuel Gridley Howe, a very prominent reformer and philanthropist, by the time she married him and moved to Boston, she plunged into radical liberal Unitarianism. She was part of the avant-garde theologically in America. And we can come back to who her two pastors were in Boston. I think people will find, especially if they know anything about antebellum religious history in America, they'll be astonished at who her big influences were. But she was educated as a child at home through tutors who even lived in the home sometimes. She was fluent in French, in German. She knew Italian. She knew Latin, Greek. As an adult, she hired a rabbi in Rome to teach her Hebrew. She was an astonishing intellect. And she was publishing review essays when she was maybe 16, 17 years old, and doing the translations from French and German herself in these translations. And I believe it's there that she was first introduced to a lot of German philosophy and theology, a lot of German literature for sure. She was a great admirer of Goethe, Schiller, but she was reading Kant. She could never get a hold of Hegel, which is the experience of a lot of people.
Yeah, I was going to say, who can?
Right. She decided at one point that he was intentionally unintelligible, but her great favorite was Kant, and she continued to lecture into the 1880s about Kant's influence on America. She was taken very seriously by American philosophers, university presidents. She spoke at the Concord School of Philosophy in the 1880s about German idealism. So she was saturated, absolutely saturated with German philosophical idealism and the theology that went along with it. So should we take her to Boston now and
I'd love to hear about that, because you know that I would like to read the full biography when it's available at some point in terms of her religious kind of transition, but understanding her ecclesiastical context and some of the views and events surrounding the pastors in Boston is also significant.
It is, and on a number of levels, because it's just assumed that she was a mainstream American Christian. People don't pay any attention to what she spent most of her time thinking about and writing about.
Yeah.
She once pointed to her library, to her granddaughter, and she said, "This is what I want to be remembered for." And she's only remembered for one poem. And that has eclipsed almost everything else about her. So when she went to Boston, and I know you'll know these names, Camden and Jeff, she first attended Theodore Parker's church in Boston, one of the most radical of the liberal Unitarians. He was in the same circles as Emerson and others in that Harvard Divinity School circle. And he was really really pushing hard to promote the higher criticism and a kind of radical Unitarianism in which Christ almost vanishes, the uniqueness of Christ, the identity of Christ. He gets to the point where he's saying, you know, we await another Christ who will be the truest and highest manifestation of the God Spirit, all this kind of stuff. Wow. And that's her pastor and very close family friend. They vacation together. After a while, they leave that church for some murky reasons, and they go off to James Freeman Clark. Now, his name is not as familiar anymore, but he was almost as prominent as Theodore Parker. And she was part of his congregation for the rest of his life into the 1880s. So probably from the 1840s to the 1880s. And then she stayed in that church when the next pastor arrived there. And by the way, her dates are 1819 to 1910. Mm. She lived a very long, productive life, and she kept diaries for decades, which very few historians have made any use of.
Yeah, that's really interesting to think. You know, speaking a little bit more generally, too, we're talking about issues regarding civil religion and even something of like a national liturgy, which you address early on in the introduction to the book. And it's interesting to see the specific theological and ecclesiastical influences upon Julia Ward Howe. But what would you say was going on in terms of, I don't know a better phrase, but like a lowest common denominator in terms of religious awareness? So you have these, you know, more conservative, traditional Episcopalian influence upon her early on, and then this really radical Unitarian. But nevertheless, there seems to be some things that people all agree on, at least as they seem to be taking shape at the time in this 19th century context. How would you describe that in terms of a civil religion? What is that in terms of the way that you pursue it in your intellectual work?
Right. I mean, that it certainly takes a lot of forms, and it's easy for me to get lost in the details, because you know that historians always want to say on the one hand, on the other hand.
Oh, scholars. We have a weasel words. No one ever wants to say anything definitive in case somebody right. finds something else.
And editors hate that. They try to get all those cautionary words right. out of what you write,
right.
and probably for good reason. You know, in some ways, and I think the historian Daniel Walker Howe has been good in pointing this out over the years, the Unitarians, and as soon as I start to generalize, I hesitate, because there are the older Unitarians. There's the first wave of Unitarianism in America, which still defended the authority of Scripture, defended the reality and necessity of miracles, reflected in a lot of ways an older Arianism, and many of them argued for Unitarianism because they believed it was required by Scripture, that Scripture simply did not teach Trinitarianism. But then there's this new wave of Unitarianism that in which I've situated Julia Ward Howe.
Right.
But all of them participate in the broader Second Great Awakening mainstream American evangelicalism. There is definitely that common denominator, which has a very strong sense that the role of the church is to help better America, that the church has a primary calling for social service, to help stamp out alcohol, to engage in prison reform, to engage in women's rights, economic reform, and then primarily the abolitionist movement. And Julia Ward Howe is at the core of that movement in Boston. Mm. So even the most radical Unitarians, no matter how much they deconstructed Christian theology and any recognizable understanding of the church and its calling, they still participated in that broad sweep of Second Great Awakening American evangelicalism.
You speak in the book about, of course, we've all heard of, Americans at least, the separation of church and state, but you kind of offer a bit of a corrective, or at least a suggestion for a different distinction, and that is not the distinction between church and state, but that of the relation and distinction between religion and nation. What kind of vistas does that open up for us? So how is that helpful maybe for getting us off one track and thinking in a more productive way?
Right. I'm so glad you asked that. This is an idea or a clarification that came to me very late in writing the book. And you've given me a wonderful opportunity here to acknowledge a debt that doesn't show up in a footnote there. Just this week, the very distinguished historian John Lukacs passed away, 95 years old. Mm. And his books have influenced me more than those of any other historian. That idea, the seed of that idea, came to me, appeared in an article that he wrote probably back in the 1990s. And this is one more influence that he had on me that I would love to acknowledge right now. And it's one of those simple shifts in our vocabulary that opens up this whole vista. As I said there, and as you just alluded to, we are in the habit of talking about church and state. We're in the habit of talking about the First Amendment. We're in the habit of there should be no, shall be no religious test for office. We are programmed to think in those terms. But the minute you just shift the vocabulary and say religion and nation, then we realize that Americans, not uniquely, but Americans throughout their history have integrated, thoroughly integrated religion and nation in a way that often makes them indistinguishable from each other. You know, we could go back and talk about the colonial settlers. We could go back and talk about the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, the First World War. Americans expect a certain level of religiosity in our public ceremonies, yeah. whether it's in front of the courthouse here in Hillsdale. Right. You know, we will still have a manger scene there because nobody gets worked up about that in this small town. And we will have all the civil religious ceremonies with generic prayers and if you raise questions about that, as you well know, if you raise any questions about that kind of generic faith, then all kinds of people react very strongly to that. This is a very sensitive issue, and maybe we can bracket that off for a whole conversation about why this is such a sensitive question, because right. it's so easy for people to misunderstand what I'm doing. I come in as the guy who reigns on the parade, and I'm trying to police boundaries between things that matter very much. But yeah, this is an American habit, but it is not a uniquely American habit. What a lot of European nations roll their eyes over about American religiosity, that this is in their own past. It's in their nationalism, in their past.
Yeah, we see a lot of debates like this. I mean, every day in the headlines. I mean, as we record, what's going on is Democratic candidates are trying to gear up all 5,000 of them to decide who's going to run against President Trump. And one who's been getting a lot of play recently, at least in the intersection between religion and nation, is Mayor Pete Buttigieg. And right. and he's arguing quite, you know, vociferously that the Republican Party doesn't own God. But then he also says if God was a Republican or was, you know, a member of a party, he sure wouldn't be a Republican. Well, that's a good point that God right. isn't owned by a political party. But it also just brings up a whole bunch of issues in terms of how the Bible has been used, how different people treat it. You know, some of the morning shows you watch, whatnot, and I sometimes, you know, dip in and watch a Morning Joe, and I'll probably be castigated by a lot of people for that. I'm an independent myself. I'm extremely conservative on many things, but I watch that because I like a lot of the commentators and whatnot, and I like getting other perspectives, as is good for everybody. But they'll often butt in. And they were responding to Franklin Graham recently, for example, and his comments regarding homosexuality, etc. And saying Jesus didn't, you know, they go off on this whole theological right. thing about what is right and wrong and what Jesus really taught and how Jesus never taught about homosexuality and dividing Jesus from the rest of them, all sorts, you name it, you know.
Right.
And
right.
then, and you just see that this is just part of the mix. And then yes. and everyone has different presuppositions, different assumptions about the Bible, about what it is, how it's supposed to be used. But generally speaking, everybody, most Americans, at least those in public discourse and those involved in the political process, have a basic idea that the president ought to be doing these kinds of things. We believe in freedom. We believe in, you know, independence, all these kinds of things. And that's insightful for me, at least, to read your book and to understand that there's a cultural national liturgy, as it were. And there, when we think of the relation between religion and nation, it's not just the nation deciding how much to allow the church to engage in terms of their worship and whatnot, but in terms of the nation, you know, invoking things into their own processes, and it's a two-way street on that front. And that's what we're really talking about here with the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Not just how much God stuff can be said in official state business, but how these ideas and these practices influence not only the state but also the church and vice versa. It goes both ways. So it's not just a risk for the state to be changed by these ideas, but also the church has been significantly altered and affected as well.
Right. Absolutely. You're singing my song. You get an A in the class.
Hey, Cameron. Cool. There thanks. Honorary degree.
Yeah. You're keeping me from grading final exams right now. Well, so we can talk for days if you like.
Jeff too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Jeff, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, I'd love to start diving into the hymn, but
this was, as some of the listeners probably know, my sixth great grandfather financed the Revolutionary War, so there's a personal element involved in this. But I very early in my studies of Edwards came to see the complex situation in this country due to the Puritan founding of New England, and there was no expectation of what we would call distinction between nation and religion, certainly not even there would have been a distinction between the magistrate and the pastor, the church and the state, but there would not have been a separation in the way that we're used to. But I remember reading Alan Heimert's book on American religion and doing a review for it and becoming aware of the fact that the situation we're in today is basically the result of an evolution or devolution of that sacred canopy, which the founding fathers and mothers held to, the covenant idea, the national covenant. And that's kind of secularized in American life now, even if it's there anymore, but it was, you know, for a time. And all of this, the writing of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, its life as a song, Machen's complaining about the singing of it in the church.
Yeah.
All of that is a result of the fact that human beings occupy different roles. They can be a Christian. They can be a member of America, you know, of the founding generation. And so on and so forth. And so this is all, but as Richard says, this is not unique to America, really. We do have, it's manifested itself in a particular way in this land, but it's not unique to us. But this is all very, very much still, as you've said, Camden, it's live history.
Oh yeah, we're living it.
Something that we've gotten beyond, right? We're still living with this, and we really do. I think, and this is where Rich's work is so helpful, is that the boundaries that he's policing are boundaries that need to be policed on both sides, by either on the side of the nation or the side of religion.
Yeah,
the boundaries need to be clear so that people recognize that when God's name is invoked in a Memorial Day prayer, that it's not necessarily the God of the triune God of Scripture whose name is being invoked.
And that's really what, you know, we're getting at here, especially with the Civil War. We have the North and the South. Both of them think that they have God on their side. There's a tremendous book by Mark Knoll on the religious history of the Civil War. I'm probably mangling that title, but you can find it if you do a search. It's a tremendous book. I think it's this Civil War is a Theological Crisis, if I remember correctly.
I think that's
correctly. Right. That's a tremendous book, which gets at that, and it explains how, even theologically, the North had really bad scriptural arguments until later in the war. And then after they came up with kind of a better hermeneutic, they started to have more progress among some of the people that were really looking at their Bibles. But this leads into the more specific issue here of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And I'm curious as to Julia Ward Howe's immediate context. What was she experiencing at the time that the battle hymn was written? Well, first off, when was it written or drafted? Where was it published? And what was going on in her mind and in the nation right then, having already kind of addressed some of her context leading up to that point?
Right. One of the things I've been able to do in this book to make I believe make an important contribution is to reconstruct exactly that experience you're talking about. There have been resources available to us that we didn't know were about her week in Washington, D.C., when she experienced so much of the front lines of the war, was inspired to write the poem. So I'm very excited about to be able to share what we now know about the immediate context there. I can even talk about the sermon she heard less than 2 days before she wrote the poem. So that has not happened before. So she, her husband was very active on the philanthropic side, a medical doctor, graduate of Harvard Medical School. He ran an institute for the deaf and blind in Boston. And when the war broke out, he and other philanthropists, ministers, politicians formed what's called the United States Sanitary Commission. A funny word today. It sounds like their job was to keep things clean, but it had to do with providing aid to soldiers, very practical aid to the soldiers in their encampments, to help families, to provide soldiers with some of the necessities and even some of the like a deck of playing cards or something like that.
This is explaining my something I've long misunderstood, because in baseball I always had to buy and wear sanitary socks. And I wondered, like, what are these necessities? You just solved the mystery for me.
There you go. And so he was active, and he and the governor of Massachusetts were close friends, and they would go back and forth to D.C. quite often in the early months of the war. But Julia Ward Howe and some of the other wives, they wanted to go along too. And on one of these trips in November of 1861, the wives came along, the governor's wife, her pastor's wife, and she came along and a few others. And she got to see wartime Washington, D.C. mobilized. Let's remind ourselves exactly where we are in the story here. Lincoln, of course, elected in November of 1860, took office in March of 1861, firing on Fort Sumter, April 1861, some early setbacks for Union forces in the summer of 1861, first Bull Run and so on. And the war was not going well at all for the Union into the fall of 1861. And she, Julia Ward Howe, was looking for some way that she could help in the war effort. She was an established poet. She had been publishing poetry since at least the 1850s. She was highly respected by Nathaniel Hawthorne, among others. And she was just looking for a way to help. She had been active in benevolent organizations. She had been very active in the abolitionist movement. And at the same time, she was also just a tourist. She wanted to take in the sights of a very exciting moment in the history of the Capitol. She stayed right in downtown D.C. and made a couple of trips over into Northern Virginia. She and her friends would take a carriage, travel out, visit the troops, because a lot of the Massachusetts regiments were stationed right there across the Potomac. So they were actually able to go and visit men and officers whom they knew personally. And they would have a meal with them. They would visit her pastor on Sunday afternoon, went out to preach to the troops. So this is the kind of thing she's busy with. And on one of these occasions, actually more than one occasion, but on an important occasion, she came out to witness a grand military display. She saw, as I said, more than one during her time in D.C. But as she was surveying the troops, reviewing the troops, there was a skirmish with Confederates at one extreme end of the Union line. And the visiting party had to quickly pack up, and all the other tourists who had come out for that day had to pack up and head back into D.C. And just like today, there's a major traffic jam trying to get back into D.C. from suburban Virginia.
95, it's all backed up.
All backed up. So as her carriage is just crawling at the pace that the soldiers are marching along the side of the road. And they were singing some of their favorite songs. They asked her to sing. She was noted as a gifted musician, pianist, and vocalist. And they were singing their favorite marching song, John Brown's Body.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is the tune that is now associated with the battle hymn. And the story she tells, which I have some doubts about, but the story that she tells 30-some years later is that her pastor said, why don't you write better words to that splendid tune? And she claimed later that that was the spark for her. And she went to sleep that night. She woke up early the next morning in the hotel. It wasn't even light yet. She scrambled around for paper and a pencil. And she wrote out what were originally six verses of the battle hymn.
Yeah.
And only five of those were published in her at that time. And you can see in the stanzas exactly the kinds of things she had been witnessing ever since her train made the last leg of its trip from Baltimore to D.C. all the way through the visits to these encampments. It's reflected in this poetry.
Wow. The draft, at least that first copy or manuscript, still exists by some really extraordinary graces, and you include that toward the end of the book, some of that history, which was, you know, recently unveiled, and if I recall correctly, there were very few, at least what we see as the original, very few changes. There was only four words or things that were altered,
right?
At least in the copy,
very
that,
little
that, yeah, that still exists today,
right?
Now,
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, but please feel free to pause and stop me. But I was going to ask more specifically, what did Howe draw upon literarily in writing this? If this was the historical context, what did she use as inspiration or other sources to provide the words that actually were used to express her experience?
One thing that becomes obvious in this poem when you do a close reading of it is that she knew her Bible cover to cover. She didn't necessarily handle her Bible correctly, but she knew her Bible. One of the things I try to emphasize in the book, that this is not original with me at all, but mid-19th century America is a biblically literate culture.
Yeah.
This is how many people learn to read. They have the cadence, the vocabulary of the King James Version in their mind.
Yeah, to assume with just hearing biblical language in a politician doesn't necessarily mean they're orthodox. Take George Washington, Lincoln, for example. Who knows what they actually believe?
That is such an important point. Yes. And it's more important, often more important, to notice what they never say rather than what they say. Mm. So her use of archaic language, mine eyes have seen, you know, this is poetic language. It has this elevated poetic style, but it sounds like the King James Version. That phrase appears very rarely in Scripture, but we might want to think of the prayer of Simeon, mine eyes have seen thy salvation. Who knows? That's me speculating, but it has that flavor to it. It sounds like the Bible. Mm-hmm. But then much more explicitly, she's picking up really violent judgment imagery from the book of Isaiah, and that as that language is echoed in Revelation. I believe Revelation 14 is that it, perhaps where it appears with the grapes of wrath and trampling out the vintage of God's wrath. Mm-hmm. So when her audience or readers saw that language, they knew immediately that she was appropriating both the Old and the New Testament and saying, this is what her eyes witnessed there on the battlefields, there in the encampments. These soldiers were the army of the Lord. Mm-hmm. You know, they're building him an altar in the evening dews and damps. And it draws loosely at some points, but specifically at others, drawing from images perhaps of Gideon and his army, perhaps Joshua and his army. And we even have in the Old Testament, as folks know, you know, the building of altars associated with these armies. So she is channeling a great deal of scripture. And I think even in the discarded sixth verse, she might be working with Psalm 110. So there's a lot going on here. But then as soon as I say all that, I've got to flip to the other side and say, one of the keys to this poem being so durable is how general it is.
Right.
It never mentions the Civil War. It never says America. It never says North, South. It never directly mentions the institution of slavery, other than those famous last lines about, as he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. You don't get a statement about emancipation. And I think this is also, it's quite similar to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address from 1863, just 2 years after she wrote this poem. Lincoln achieves very similar results. And we have to check ourselves. I say this to people, they say, oh, this can't be true. But then they go back and read the text of the Gettysburg Address, and they see that it doesn't say North, South, never mentions Gettysburg. It speaks in this very evocative language that is then so easily appropriated symbolically by later generations. And that's part of the reason why the battle hymn just goes on and on and on.
Well, there's tremendous literary skill in that, because just the power in people's assumptions. I mean, you're almost writing in a way, whether intentionally or unintentionally, that people can latch onto it and import what they want into this work, into this hymn. And then and it's done in such a kind of natural way where the appropriator, whoever that is, either in 1861 or in 2019, just assumes that how and the hymn is on their side, whatever side that is.
You just
own it, and you feel like, yeah, this person understands me, but may or may not.
I do have a question, though. I mean, where in the scriptures is it mentioned that Christ was born in the beauty of the lilies? Just a question.
Right. Now, Jeff, I'm laughing because you've put your finger on the most mysterious part of a mysterious poem. We've had all kinds of speculation over the last 150 years, and she herself never definitively answered that question. I think one of the best suggestions, explanations, is that she's associating the lilies with artistic depictions in medieval and Renaissance art of Virgin Mary being presented with the lilies by the angel Gabriel at the Annunciation. That doesn't really make sense, though, when you read the text of the poem. So I'm not entirely convinced by that.
Yeah.
And it is a strange, strange verse, that last verse. In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. You know, and what does transfiguration mean there? It's a very odd way of speaking of redemption, because she doesn't believe in the atonement. We could have a long conversation about what she doesn't believe.
Yeah.
She doesn't believe anything affirmed by the Apostles' Creed. So all of this has become highly abstract redemptive language.
So that's fascinating in its own right, but I'm really interested in understanding how the hymn was received early on, and then how was it published? How was it made known? And then how did it become something that was sung as Union soldiers were marching? I mean, they had other songs. How did this one become the one?
I think one of the misunderstandings about the poem, which is commonplace and has been repeated so often, is that it was a favorite of the soldiers.
Mm.
There is surprisingly little evidence that that was ever the case.
Yeah, they really didn't like it, many of them, right?
Well, and they thought that you could never march into battle singing, for example, in the Beauty of the Lilies. I mean, who's going to face enemy gunfire and artillery singing in the Beauty of the Lilies? And they always preferred the original doggerel of the John Brown song.
Yeah.
So how it became popularized is a fascinating question, because this is one example of how we in 2019 actually have the opportunity to know more about its original popularity than Julia Ward Howe ever did, because of the incredible digital resources we have, how we can search newspapers, something like newspapers.com or the Library of Congress. I've been able to find more than I could ever possibly use, more examples of this poem appearing immediately in January of 1862.
Mm.
To answer your earlier question, and to organize my thoughts here, the poem was purchased by the Atlantic Monthly magazine.
Yeah.
She was already a regular contributor of poetry and essays to the Atlantic Monthly in Boston. Her editor purchased the poem, featured it on the front page of the February 1862 issue. He's the one who gave it the name, The Battle Hymn of the Republic. It did not have that title.
Yeah.
And as still happens today, there are these preview copies and announcements sent out to newspapers. So a month earlier, in the middle of January, the New York Times already knows what the table of contents is for the forthcoming Atlantic Monthly. They know that there's a poem by Julia Ward Howe. They have a copy of the poem. It appears first anywhere in print in the pages of the New York Herald Tribune, probably the largest circulation newspaper in America, perhaps the largest circulation newspaper in the world. And Horace Greeley, the editor of that, was a very prominent social reformer. So that's where it appeared, and it was picked up by newspapers all across the country, especially New England, Upper Midwest, California. And I believe that Julia Ward Howe died not knowing just how many people had seen her poem. Oh. In fact, more people had seen this one poem than anything else she had ever published.
Wow.
That's pretty obvious.
And she lived 49 more years, correct?
Right. Yeah. It's incredible. Yeah. And she was lucid and still writing in her diary up to the very end.
Wow.
And it's picked up. I'll tell you one story. Part of the puzzle, the mystery, is the intersection between Julia Ward Howe and evangelicalism.
Mm.
How does this poem get picked up and embraced almost immediately by American evangelicals, whose theology is totally different from her theology?
Mm-hmm,
one of the things we notice in the poem is that there is nothing distinctly, definitively Unitarian about it. So it has that vagueness we were talking about earlier, not only vagueness historically about the circumstances, but a vagueness theologically, which makes it very easy for perhaps naive Christians to start singing. But there was a chaplain, a Methodist chaplain by the name of McCabe, and he read the poem in the Atlantic Monthly. He committed it to memory. And later, when he was imprisoned in Libby Prison in Virginia,
Richmond,
he sang it with the inmates there, and taught them the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Mm.
And then he had quite a career. He sang it in front of President Lincoln. He sang it as a fundraiser for all kinds of organizations. And I think I just slipped there a second ago. I think Jeff caught me about Libby Prison.
In Richmond, yeah.
Yeah, in Richmond.
Good catch.
Wow. So it spread very widely, and it started appearing in sermons. I have examples surprisingly early of how quickly some New England clergymen were incorporating the poem into their sermons. Her own pastor started using it in the pulpit in Boston, and from there it just spread and spread and spread.
In that regard, you know, we think of it so bound up with the Civil War. That was its original context, but it endured, obviously, for many, many years. What did Howe do after the Civil War was concluded? Did this hymn, I mean, obviously it followed her around, but did it ever pose problems for her later on? Was it an advantage that she had written this? How did it affect her life after the war?
Right. That's a great question. And it's a little too complex to map out. Part of what I try to do in the book here is I try to make the case that she starts remembering the poem and the war in a different way because she becomes so closely identified with the poem. And she starts quoting it as a way to explain her own emotions at the time. And that may not sound like a strange thing to do, but she starts reading the significance of the Civil War and the significance of America and of America's future wars by quoting the lines of her own poetry. Mm. And it's
even
it's
the Spanish-American War, right?
What's that?
Spanish-American War in 1898, yes. With the similar thing. Right. So this has become kind of this like living biographical appendage, I suppose, to her. She lives her life through it, kind of.
Sometimes she loved the celebrity it brought her, and sometimes she hated it. She was once called in a newspaper a mono poet, that she was known for only one poem, and that's all she would ever be known for. And
a victim of her success.
That turned out to be prophetic.
Yeah, precisely. And that's what people know her for. But I guess it is that having such a wild success, that's all that people ever know you for, a victim of it.
Right.
A one-hit wonder.
Man. Yeah,
exactly.
Who has many hits.
You know, that frustrated her.
Yeah, I could imagine.
She had written so much poetry.
Sure.
Poetry that was popular during the Civil War, poems like My Country, The Flag, very well known, but she was reduced down to this one poem, but then she made the best of it. It was being sung all over the world. It was being translated into foreign languages, Armenian, Italian. So she knew later that it was the key to her fame, international fame, and her own daughters continued to promote this as a cottage industry. They wrote books about the battle hymn, and they became very defensive about the reputation of that poem and the proper interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Howe kind of viewed the America in 1898 or thereabouts of the Spanish-American War as having moved from an Old Testament era to a New Testament era. What does she mean by that, and how does that reveal something about her and how she treated this poem?
Right. That's one of my favorite things she ever said. It's almost as if I made it up just for her to say it. there's a great historian at Penn, Walter McDougall, and he wrote a book in the 1990s called Promised Land, Crusader State. And this was his chosen metaphor to say America had its old testament of its foreign policy and ideology as a promised land, a refuge, and then its New Testament of being missionary, evangelistic, trying to transform other parts of the world. And he's not a fan. So here's Julia Ward Howe.
Maybe we're Old Testament again now, I guess. We're having a fight over this right now.
Yeah. Right. So then here she is in about 1900, when there are American troops, U.S. Marines in China in the context of the Boxer Rebellion. She's very excited about this. And she said, in these impromptu remarks that she recorded in her diary and are recorded elsewhere from people who were present, she said, "It is time for us to turn from our Old Testament of liberty for ourselves to our New Testament of liberty for others." So here she is making the same point that a scholar will make later, but she's calling upon America to embrace this global redemptive mission. And she has always had a global vision. She was a great proponent of the nationalist movements in Europe all the way back to the 1840s. She was a supporter of Hungarian independence, Polish reunification, Italian unification, German unification. She believed that this was the trajectory of history, that this was part of the dialectic of history. And so even then on after the Civil War, she's seeing the unification of Italy in 1870 as a fulfillment of God's plan for history. And she sees that all the way down to 1900 and beyond, that America is in a sense obeying her battle hymn. It is dying to make men free.
Yeah.
Way beyond America's borders.
What did you mentioned it has been translated, but did this poem, the hymn, ever become appropriated in any public way in other countries? Was it ever appealed to as some sort of mission or civil religion that the country, or at least a faction of a country, should sign up for?
Right. In England, it had a very surprising longevity. It is still sung there today.
Really?
Yes, it's in the Church of England hymn book.
Wow.
And they love the sixth verse that she discarded. That's a quirky story about how that became well known. So it has been used. It's been used as a way to celebrate America as a valued ally. You know, this is how the British are likely to use it in World War I, World War II, Cold War. But definitely others have sung it as capturing this vision of human emancipation, of national liberation. So the way it's being used to interpret World War I later, the way it's sung in Constantinople and Istanbul in the 1870s as part of this wider vision for human liberation, in that case against the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah. Well, I always hear it. Most years I go back to my homeland, my hometown, a very small town, still to this day has no stoplights. It's that small. But we have an old cemetery in town. My brother serves on the board of it now, but there's, you know, Revolutionary War soldiers that are buried there. Most of the Busey side, my family is buried there. Maybe someday I'll be buried there myself, but they always sing the battle hymn. At the Memorial Day service. I might not make it this year on the 27th, but perhaps I will. But that always reminds me that this is just part of this thing, you know, and the church choir comes to sing it. The church where I grew up, which with the church itself, was founded in 1844. So there's a long history there. Who knows how many times that hymn has been sung, not just by church people, but in the church services. So I want to ask you, I mean, as we think about this more from a contemporary viewpoint, how does the battle hymn function today? And just, you know, I know this is trying to condense an entire long scholarly book into kind of one little short tidbit, but you know, I know we're not a morning news cycle where we're just giving you 1 minute to tell us what this book's about. At the same time, do you find this battle hymn being more of a hindrance than a help? Or you know, how help us to understand this, and how can we kind of think about the use of the battle hymn moving forward in perhaps a more intelligent, measured way, at least those of us who are confessionally reformed?
Right, exactly. It certainly does not belong in our public worship. Mm. It is such a mangling of biblical text and theology. A confessional Christian cannot accept this reuse of the Bible for the purposes of America's wars and for sustaining the American nation state. And this is part of that complexity we're talking about earlier. You can be patriotic, you can love your country, and you can love your church. And here in America, we are spoiled rotten. We still have the ability to love our country and love our church. Mm-hmm. But if you are singing a song about America's redemptive mission, written by a woman who denied every doctrine of the faith, there's something serious wrong. So I, in a way, I want to give people a bad conscience about this hymn. And also, I want people to understand that this, the battle hymn, is far more violent and apocalyptic than people realize, because they're not paying attention to the words. They don't, you know, they just sing along about God trampling out the vintage, where the grapes of wrath are stored. This is some of the bloodiest imagery of the Old and New Testament. And if we take that out of the context of God's righteous judgment, it's horrifying.
Yeah, people throw a fit over singing imprecatory psalms. Those are inspired words. Those are God's inspired words.
Camden, I think I love you.
It's wild.
Anyway, that's a fantastic point. You not only passed the course, you now get an A.
Get a prize. That's right.
Wow. That's extra credit right there.
Now, even those we want to always explain within the redemptive historical context, but I don't shy away from, we sing an imprecatory psalm here or there. I always try to explain it and understand, but this is, you know, the Lord will come in judgment and wrath. He's stayed that for a time, but his medium and his forces for bringing that wrath is not the United States of America.
Right.
As much of a patriot as I am, it's just not the case.
Right. And maybe we can extend the analogy here. Right? There is no redemptive historical context for the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Yeah.
There is for the imprecatory Psalms.
Yeah, sure.
But there is not for the Battle Hymn of the Republic. It cannot be baptized and brought into the church for public worship.
Mm.
And then, you know, nobody's going to ask me for permission to sing it on the 4th of July out in the public square. But there too, I think Christians have to be very cautious about what they sing, what they affirm in public by singing these words. And I know this gets difficult. I know there's the question of good manners, and I struggle with this myself. I struggle with this with the Pledge of Allegiance. What is expected of us simply as good manners, and not to draw attention to ourselves by some act of civil disobedience in this way?
So I don't
know what to tell people to do in every circumstance. But the more you know about the battle hymn, the less singable it is.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a lesson for the day. I mean, Richard, this has been really fascinating and just opened my eyes to all sorts of things I did not know before. So thanks for joining us today and for speaking not only to us, but sharing this with all of our listeners, and most of all for writing the book. This has been tremendous. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Camden. I have benefited so much from your work with Reform Forum, Boss Group. Thank you so much.
Well, praise God.
So, and Jeff, it's great to talk with you as well.
You too.
Well, I got to say, you know, everyone needs to get a copy of this book, A Fiery Gospel, The Battle Hymn of the Republic and the Road to Righteous War. Again, in the Religion in American Public Life series, is published by Cornell University Press. Don't let that scare you if you're not a scholar or an historian. It is a university press, but this is a tremendously readable book, and any literate adult, you know, should be able to follow this just fine. And it's tremendously well written, and a lot of insightful material there, and it is well researched and all, so the scholars are not going to be lacking either. But it's a book for everybody, so take a look at it. You can find it online. You know, I've got a copy on Kindle, so you can find it there right now, I believe. And you can also get it in hardcover at least by Wednesday, May 15th, but you can pre-order it now, and we'll have links to that in the episode description. So everybody will be able to find it there. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can get a hold of us at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about everything we're doing, all of our programs, resources, publications, and upcoming events. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We do hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.